Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take to pass the Affordable Care Act of 2010, and what impact will it have on Americans' physical and financial health as more of its requirements take effect over the next few years? After long months of consultations with stakeholders and analysts, and of public and private deal-making by political allies and opponents alike, the measure some Americans refer to as Obamacare was signed into law on March 23rd of 2010. Not all of its provisions have come online, and opponents continue to mount legal challenges to certain components of the law, including the pending mandate for Americans to buy insurance or pay a penalty. Joining us to talk about the law, its history, and how it might affect us all is John E. McDonough. He's professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and served as senior advisor on national health reform to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. He also played a key role in the design and passage of the 2006 Massachusetts health law, and he is the author of the new book, Inside National Health Reform. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Start, if you would, with a little history of the effort to expand health insurance coverage so that most Americans have access to affordable care. FDR, I guess, was the first president to seriously consider such a proposal, but multiple presidents after him, Democrats and Republicans, have at least been interested in the idea.
So there were 8 U.S. presidents, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, including Harry Truman, including Lyndon Johnson, including Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, who made trying to achieve some national health care system with coverage for everyone a priority while that individual was president. Only LBJ had success, from Texas, of course, in 1965 with the law creating Medicare and Medicaid. And other presidents tried very hard, and probably Harry Truman the most, and were unsuccessful. And so the effort in 2008 through 2010 to create what led to the passage of the Affordable Care Act had a lot of history going into it. And everybody who was involved, senators, representatives on both parties, and staff, and so many others, were deeply cognizant of the past errors and the past mistakes and consciously tried to create strategy that would not repeat those errors from the past. Just to give maybe one quick example, Bill Clinton made a big effort in 1993 and 1994 that was spectacularly unsuccessful.
Dead on arrival, essentially.
And part of the challenge when people look back on it was he came into office in January 1993. He couldn't get a bill to Congress until late November 1993, so more than 10 crucial months of time when the president's newly elected political capital starts to diminish. And by the time he got it in, it was too hard a sell. And so one of the lessons from that was that if you're serious about achieving some kind of national health reform and universal coverage, you have to move quickly. You have to move fast and not waste time. And that weighed very heavily on the minds of everybody as we move forward and, of course, led to the criticism, why are you doing this so quickly? And, of course, many people say this went far too fast. Other people say, why did it take so darn long? And, you know, there's truth in both of those perspectives.
Another major difference between 1993 and 2008 was that many more representatives from the business community by 2008 were really concerned about the rapidly rising costs of healthcare premiums. Why have things gotten so much more expensive in 15 years?
Well, because the United States as a nation and all of the states are on a track where every single year the rise in growth of our healthcare system, the cost of our healthcare system, and the cost of health insurance premiums, both for private coverage and for public coverage, keep going up 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation. And so you notice it, and it pinches you every single year. But when you look back 5 or 10 or 15 years, it is simply breathtaking. When Bill Clinton was trying to reform healthcare in 1993 and 1994, healthcare accounted for about 10 to 11% of the gross domestic product in the United States. And now we're shooting up around 18% and even higher. And so it has become so large And at the same time, while healthcare has become so expensive, we have just a mountain of evidence telling us that Americans are not getting the value from the money we're spending on healthcare that we should. So the uninsured and the underinsured, people without insurance or people with inadequate insurance, is one important motivator. But another important motivator is just how much everybody is paying for those people who do have coverage and how painful it is every year when the cost increases just keep coming inexorably at us.
So toward the end of 2008, the late Senator Kennedy put together a work group to talk about options for expanding health coverage and controlling costs. What sort of stakeholders were invited to participate?
The stakeholders included folks from the healthcare industry, so hospitals, physicians, drug companies, medical supply manufacturers, labor unions. There were a bunch of business groups in the room, consumer advocacy organizations, disease groups like the American Cancer Society, the insurance industry. We had pretty much all of the stakeholders who had a loud and significant opinion about what should happen sitting around a large table in the Dirksen Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C.
And after some talking in that meeting, you essentially presented three directions that the group might consider taking: Constitution Avenue, Independence Avenue, and Massachusetts Avenue. What proposals did those three street names represent?
So we started out by having a big macro discussion of what major direction were people of a mind to take. And so by Constitution Ave, we said, let's do something really big. Let's overturn the whole system. Let's do Medicare for all, what some people refer to as a single-payer financing system, or something like Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon was proposing, which was to create a new private market for everybody and eliminate employer coverage almost entirely. So thinking big, thinking broad for a big and broad and deep problem. That was Constitution Ave. Independence Avenue was saying, listen, people don't like big change all at once and too fast, so let's go carefully, let's go slowly, let's do some incremental changes, maybe expand state high-risk pools, expand Medicaid a little bit, create some subsidies, but let's not do anything that's going to get any of the stakeholders particularly upset and trying to prevent something happen, and let's get something done quickly. It won't be nearly universal. It will rely on the states largely, and let's see how we can do that. And so we called that Independence Avenue. And then the third avenue we called Massachusetts Avenue. And by that, what we said was, what about an approach which models the health insurance expansions that were done in Massachusetts in 2006, which rested on what's sometimes referred to as a three-legged stool. And the first leg of the stool deals with reforming insurance markets to eliminate the practices that insurance companies use, including in Texas today, to exclude people who have had some illness from buying health insurance or charge them two, three, four times as much as other people. So to create a system known as guaranteed issue, where everybody is guaranteed the right to get coverage when they need it. So that's the first leg. The second leg is something known as the individual responsibility requirement, or people know it probably more familiarly as the individual mandate. So if we're going to create guaranteed issue, we have to make sure everybody gets in and participates in insurance coverage. And so that's the second leg. And then the third leg was subsidies to help people afford the cost of coverage, both making premiums affordable and also limiting the cost sharing, the deductibles and the copays to which people could be exposed. So those are the three basic foundations of Massachusetts health reform, as well as creating something known as a health insurance exchange or a connector in Massachusetts, which is a mechanism for people to be able to buy health insurance more easily and quickly and be able to do apples-to-apples comparisons. So we called that Massachusetts Ave. So we gave the stakeholders around the table the choice, and we, after about an hour or so of discussion, we said, which way do you want to go? And nobody thought Constitution Ave made sense. Nobody thought Independence Avenue was a route that they wanted to go down. And everybody in the room, except for the folks representing the business community, said, we want to go down Massachusetts Avenue this time and see if we can do that. And the business people came along. They had some concerns up front that we were able to address. But as we went through the process in 2008 into 2009 of designing what the plan would look like, it really was a travel down Massachusetts Avenue.
Is it reasonable to accept the contention from insurance companies that the only way to make this work and to potentially lower premiums down the line is to require that individual mandate?
Well, there are other ways. So to get to some kind of universal coverage or big system reform, you could do, for example, what a lot of progressive Democrats want, which is a Canadian-style Medicare for all type system where we just expand Medicare to everybody in the country. Now, of course, Medicare also includes mandates. Everybody listening who's working is paying taxes that are supporting Medicare, and you don't have a choice whether to pay or not to pay. So there's a mandate in there as well. But the challenge is this, and we've seen this happen in Massachusetts and a few other states. If you say that health insurance is available for everybody and everybody can come and buy it when they want, and you don't tie it to a mandate, then some significant number of people, not everybody, not most, but a significant number of people to create trouble for you will wait until they get sick before they go and buy health insurance. And if you have enough people doing that, then the impact of that is that sicker and older people jump in and buy coverage, and younger, healthier people don't. And then everybody who's buying health insurance sees their premiums rise significantly because of the folks who are then not participating in the system. And so if you want to go to a system where everybody has the right to buy health insurance coverage, it has to be linked with some kind of a mandate to purchase, because otherwise you really can do some serious harm to the affordability within the system. And that was advanced by the insurance industry, but it was readily accepted by most of the consumer organizations, labor, and the healthcare delivery system folks who were part of the process. It was not a controversial contention, and the truth is, and this is one of the many huge ironies of the health reform process, the notion of an individual mandate absolutely came from the Republican side of the fence. It started with a conservative health economist, Mark Pauly, from Pennsylvania in the 1980s. It was embraced by the Heritage Foundation. When Republicans fought the Clinton health plan in 1993 and 1994, they proposed an individual mandate as an alternative, and that was moderates like John Danforth from Missouri and John Chafee from Rhode Island, but it was very much embraced by Orrin Hatch from Utah, Chuck Grassley from Iowa, and Bob Dole from Kansas, among many, many other Republicans. And so throughout then the intervening 15 years between the Clinton plan and the Obama initiative, Republicans continued to say the individual mandate is the way to go. That's what we have to do. That's the appropriate alternative. And the best example is that in June of 2009, Senator Grassley from Iowa was on Fox News, and he said, listen, we've just got to be grown-ups and understand there's no way to do this without a mandate. In September 2009, he said, listen, the reason I oppose this law is because of an individual mandate. It was a huge ground shift within the Republicans that led to the abandonment of something that they had advanced for more than 20 years.
My guest is John E. McDonough, professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. His new book is called Inside National Health Reform. We'll talk more about this in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John E. McDonough. He's professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and served as senior advisor on national health reform to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. If you'd like to join our conversation about his new book, Inside National Health Reform, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We could certainly spend this entire hour and probably several others, John, talking about the machinations required to get this law passed and the inclusions and deletions. But I want to jump into what is included in the law itself, because there remains a lot of confusion and concern about this. Let's talk about the measures that have already taken effect, one of which is that young people can remain on their parents' health insurance plans until they turn 26 years old.
Yes. So that is one of about 20 reforms to the health insurance market that took effect last fall, and others took effect this past January. So there is now the ability, if you have a child and you have private health insurance, you can keep your child on your family policy until the child reaches the age of 26. And that was something that was done in Massachusetts. It was done in a number of other states, each using different age limits, and it's now a national policy. And it not only applies to state-regulated policies, so when a state does it, it can only affect the policies that it actually regulates. It now applies to all of the large employer plans across the country. And the census data that came out just yesterday, which showed an increase in the overall number of uninsured, not as much as some people feared, but still an increase, also showed within the data that the rate of uninsurance among young adults has actually gone down. The estimate is about 500,000 younger adults have health insurance now than had it a year ago, and one of the significant factors believed to be involved in this is this new allowance for people to stay on their parents' policy. So that is one example. Another example is, as of last fall, it is now illegal for health insurance policies to have what are known as lifetime benefit caps. So I buy a policy, I end up getting some serious cancer, I don't even realize it, but I need very expensive treatment, and I find then that I have, for example, $1 million benefit cap, and when I reach that cap, my policy no longer helps me at all. That is illegal now. And they're also diminishing the ability of insurers to put in place annual benefit caps. And all of this is done to try to make health insurance better for what Americans need in today's society because of the significant cost of getting sick when you are when you're seriously ill.
What's happened to the famous Medicare prescription drug donut hole?
So when the Medicare drug plan, otherwise known as Part D, was created by Congress back in 2003, in order to keep the cost down, they included what is known as a coverage gap within the program. And so and it goes up a little bit every year, but generally, so for the first $2,500 of your drug expenses, Medicare will pay for a big portion of that cost, and then there's about a $3,000 gap between about $2,500 and $5,500, where Medicare pays nothing, and you are 100% on your own. And then if your costs go above that level in the high $5,000 range, then Medicare again kicks in and pays a significant part of the cost. And that was done in 2003 in designing the program to try to lower the overall costs to the federal taxpayers. And so within the Affordable Care Act, over about an eight-year period, which has already started, there will be a shrinking of the so-called donut hole so that by 2019, about 75% of those costs within the donut hole will now be covered by the Medicare program. And that was done as part of a big process involving the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry was actually very helpful in figuring out a pathway to close the donut hole. So those are just three examples of about 25 different reforms that have already happened. If the Affordable Care Act just included these reforms, people would have said, you know, that's a pretty big, far-reaching, important law. In fact, those 25 reforms in the early phase of the law's implementation are just a harbinger of much, much more fundamental things to come. The big thing that I mentioned, the guaranteed issue, the insurance market reform, the individual mandate, and the creation of the new subsidies, as well as the expansions in Medicaid programs, all don't take effect until estimated now January 2014.
So let's talk about that mandate. This essentially says that in 2014, everyone must buy into some sort of insurance plan or else pay a penalty. Is it a penalty to the IRS?
Yes, mm-hmm. Right.
How is that going to be policed and enforced?
Well, so we know because we've actually had experience in Massachusetts seeing it up close and personal, and it's roughly the same device. So in Massachusetts, and this started back in 2007, if you are of a certain income where it's judged you're able to afford to buy health insurance for yourself and you don't do it, then you pay a yearly penalty, and you pay that penalty as part of your taxes when you fill them out in the spring of each year for the prior year. And so in Massachusetts now, the highest the penalty can go is about $1,200 a year for not having coverage. It's not really, in some ways, the term individual mandate is a misnomer, because it's not a mandate to buy health insurance. What it says is that if you can afford to buy health insurance and you don't, then you have to pay a financial penalty for not doing so. Switzerland is an example of a country that has a serious, real individual mandate. In Switzerland, the government orders you to buy health insurance. If you don't do it, the government buys it for you and sends you a bill and makes sure you pay.
Hmm.
Here in the United States, in Massachusetts, and in the Affordable Care Act, what we have is a financial penalty on you. So in Massachusetts, for example, every year about 30,000 people say, I'm going to pay the penalty as opposed to buying health insurance. They are allowed to do that, and they are complying with the law.
Are hospitals expecting to reform and contract their charity care operations because of this?
So hospitals were an important part of the process, and hospitals supported the passage of the law. And one of the reasons they supported passage is because nationally right now about 17% of Americans don't have health insurance coverage. And when those people get sick, a lot of them go to community health centers. Most of them end up going to hospitals. And hospitals are left holding the bag for a huge amount of what is known as uncompensated care, for services they provide and bills that they simply can't collect. So hospitals are expecting, if the law is fully implemented, and the intention and the design of the law is to try to get the coverage of all Americans from the current about 83% up to about 95%, that hospitals will be significantly more financially stable as a result of this increase in the proportion of Americans who have health insurance. And so that's one of the reasons they were significant supporters of the law. There's a lot else in the law that is requiring hospitals to try and improve the medical care that they deliver. So, for example, there are requirements in the law that hospitals have to do a much better job in terms of preparing patients for when they get discharged so that the patients don't end up being what's known as a preventable readmission, coming back into the hospital within 30 days because they weren't properly cared for and prepared for discharge when they go. So there's a lot in there that the hospital industry wants and supports and likes, and there's a lot in there that's going to require hospitals to pay much more attention to the quality of care and the efficiency and effectiveness of care that they provide.
Have the costs of that uncompensated hospital care simply affected the bottom lines of particularly the for-profit institutions, or have they been built into the costs that you and I and our insurance companies pay when we do have the money to pay for care?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
So hospitals have to eat losses, eat the financial losses. To the extent that they are able in their market to shift costs on to other payers, you and me and businesses out there buying health insurance for their workers, they will do so. Not all hospitals have the same leverage within their markets to do that kind of cost shifting. If they are able to do it, they will do it. So it hurts hospitals, and it also increases the price and cost of care and health insurance for everybody else.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jim calling from Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hi there. Switch on the Republican Party on the individual mandate was just a characteristic of their reactionary nature. But the question I have is, if the courts continue to rule that it is unconstitutional to mandate these people to our citizenship to buy insurance, what will happen at that point?
That most recent ruling was last month, John. Is that right?
So there have been a number of federal district courts that have ruled. The key courts to watch are the courts of appeal. And so far, three courts of appeal have ruled on challenges to the Affordable Care Act. They have all pretty much agreed that the challenge, to the extent that there's a remaining challenge, is to the individual mandate and to nothing else. So if the courts rule, the mandate could be struck down. If it goes to the Supreme Court, which people believe now it will, and if the court were to rule against it, then they would strike down the individual mandate. The rest of the law would stand. And there have been three courts of appeals ruling so far. One court of appeals upheld the constitutionality of the ACA. One court of appeals ruled against the constitutionality of the individual mandate. And a third court of appeal dismissed the case, including that was one of the cases from the Attorney General of the state of Virginia, Ken Cuccinella. And but in dismissing the case, also gave a rationale which was a very strongly backing of supporters of the constitutionality of the law. So it's really kind of at this point in terms of courts of appeal, 2-1 in favor of the law. I don't think it's my opinion that at the end of the day, what the Supreme Court does, and I expect they will rule on it one way or another, and I don't know which way they'll go. It's a jump ball and a game of chance at this point almost. But I don't think ultimately what the Supreme Court does is nearly as important as what happens on November 6th, 2012, which I'm actually starting to view as a national plebiscite on the Affordable Care Act. Because here are two scenarios. Let me just give them to you really briefly. So let's say that the Supreme Court rules that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. Then let's suppose for a moment, hypothetically, that in November 2012, Democrats hold on to the White House, hold on to the Senate, and retake the House of Representatives. If they do that, they will be able to come in early 2013 and amend the Affordable Care Act. All they have to do is change one word. In the individual mandate section, all they have to do is cross out the word penalty and insert the word tax, or just insert the word tax in front of penalty and call it a tax penalty. If they do that, there is no argument about its constitutionality. It's clear that Congress has the power to levy that kind of a tax. One court of appeals said it is a tax. Two others said it's not a tax, so that's part of the argument. Let's consider the converse. Let's say that the Supreme Court upholds the constitutionality of the individual mandate. And then let's assume hypothetically that in November 2012, Republicans win the White House, win control of the Senate, and hold on to control of the U.S. House of Representatives. If they do that, it is fairly certain that they will come in early 2013 and repeal the vast amount of the Affordable Care Act, regardless of what the Supreme Court does. So ultimately, the determinative body and process relates not to whatever the Supreme Court decides. It relates to what will happen in the federal elections in the fall of 2012. That is really becoming increasingly a national referendum on whether people want to keep or repeal the vast majority of what's in the ACA.
Given that so much of this has not yet taken effect, John, do you feel confident that Americans fully understand what it is they're voting for or against when they go to the polls in November?
One of the things that's clear is there is massive confusion among the American public about what this law actually does. There are some things that are just flat-out wrong. There's one poll that showed that about 20% of Americans believe that the law has already been repealed. There are other polls that show that about 30% of Americans believe that there are bona fide death panels in the law, government bureaucrats who will actually make decisions. This Medicare enrollee will live, and this Medicare enrollee will die. But beyond that, aside from some of the more ridiculous, sorry to use that word, assumptions that some people are making, people do not understand this law, but it backs up because it's even more fundamental than that. Most Americans really don't have a good, deep understanding of the U.S. healthcare system and how it actually works. And if you don't understand the healthcare system, it's awfully darn hard to understand this complex law, which is trying to do comprehensive reform toward a maddeningly complex U.S. healthcare system. So one of the big challenges between now and the fall of 2012 is to do everything we can. Not so much, I'm not trying in my book, Inside National Health Reform, to make people think this is a wonderful, great law. What I'm really trying to help people to do is to understand what the law is itself so that people can make up their own minds and make their own judgments.
John E. McDonough is with us. He's professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and served as senior advisor on national health reform to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. He also played a key role in the design and passage of the 2006 Massachusetts health law. His new book is called Inside National Health Reform. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Harvard School of Public Health Professor John E. McDonough about his new book, Inside National Health Reform. John, I want to talk about this. There are Americans who oppose the individual mandate on ideological grounds. There are many people who are concerned about how we're going to pay for all this, particularly things like expanding Medicaid to cover people at much higher levels above the poverty rate when we have struggled to pay for Medicaid and Medicare as it is. Talk about how the formulas work that allow this to be affordable, at least for people who support and agree with the law.
Okay, thanks. So in terms of Medicaid, and again, when we say who's going to pay, you know, there's the question of how much is it going to cost the state and how much is it going to cost the federal government. So let me just take each of those briefly. So in terms of the state, for the expansions in Medicaid that are scheduled to take effect in early 2014. The Medicaid expansions for the first 3 years are going to be paid for the newly eligible people, 100% by the federal government. So the state of Texas, which has a lot of uninsured folks, a
26%.
Large number of uninsured folks who will be eligible for coverage through the state Medicaid program, will have to pay nothing for those first 3 years. And then over the course of the next several years, the rate of reimbursement by the federal government drops to 90% and no lower than that. So that is a hugely significant financial burden assumed by the federal government, and by the way, in a huge economic boom for Texas from the federal government. So then the second question is, so how is the federal government paying for this? And the Congressional Budget Office is the nonpartisan budget estimator for all laws coming through Congress. And they have estimated that the full cost of the Affordable Care Act over a 10-year period, and that's the standard period they look to in evaluating how much something will cost, that the full cost of the Affordable Care Act, including the Medicaid expansions, is paid for. So much so that for the first 10 years, the CBO estimates that the law will actually reduce the federal deficit by about $74 billion. Now, $74 billion sounds like a lot. It's not a lot given the U.S. fiscal situation right now. But the estimate is that over 10 years, if implemented as done, the Affordable Care Act doesn't increase the deficit at all. Compare that and contrast that with the law that passed Congress in 2003, creating the Medicare Prescription Drug Program, the Part D program. That was during President George W. Bush's administration when Republicans controlled the Senate and controlled the House. They passed this new benefit for Medicare enrollees, and they put the entire cost of that law onto the federal treasury. So the estimate of the CBO is that over the next 10 years, for the federal debt, the Medicare prescription drug program will increase the federal deficit by more than $1 trillion in the same 10-year window that the Affordable Care Act will actually reduce the federal deficit. Now, a lot of people say flat out, well, I just don't believe that. Well, the Congressional Budget Office is the pretty much only neutral arbiter that we've got that looks at the impact of all of these kinds of reforms, and that's their conclusion. The Part D program wasn't paid for a penny. It was all loaded onto the national debt to be paid by us, our children, and our grandchildren. And the Affordable Care Act is more than fully paid for, including the Medicaid expansions. And frankly, you know, a lot of us, I mean, and you know, you've said it, I'm up here in the North. I'm up here in a blue state, Massachusetts to Texas connection here. But the truth is that the enormous numbers of uninsured Americans are not up here in New England. They're down there in the Sun Belt. And so one way to look at the Affordable Care Act in terms of the money is to see an enormous flow of resources out of the North and down into the Sun Belt states, including Texas, who will see enormous financial benefits if the law is implemented as it's currently written.
Interestingly, we have a lot of questions coming in via email about things like vision and dental insurance. Are these covered by the Affordable Care Act at all?
For the most part, no.
Mm-hmm.
And I regret that, but there is simply, you know, again, in terms of trying to meet the fiscal targets and keeping the total cost of the legislation under $1 trillion, it was simply not possible to add those kinds of benefits as much as we would certainly like to see them. We'd like to see, you know, I think it's a shame that the Medicare program, for example, has absolutely no coverage of dental or oral health services when that's such a critical need for senior citizens. But, you know, this was not a law that was able to or attempted to do everything for everybody. And so, no, that's not really covered under the law.
We've heard a lot of concerns from people worried that this is a job-killing law. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the requirements and how they have changed for employers who might have provided insurance in the past, might now be required to provide insurance. How does that all work?
So there's some significant confusion. The Congressional Budget Office said that there would be people who would not be employed because of the implementation of the law. The people they were referring to are folks in their early 60s who are hanging on for dear life, waiting until they get to age 65, and then getting on Medicare. And so they're hanging on to their jobs. They would like to retire early. They would like to stop working, but they can't because then they will lose their employer health insurance. And the Affordable Care Act, if you retire early, provides you with a way and a path to be able to get affordable health insurance outside of your employer. So some number of those in the tens of thousands across the country are going to voluntarily stop working, not because they don't want to lose their jobs, they want to give up their jobs, they're ready to retire, but right now they feel trapped because of the inability to get health insurance. And so when Republicans say it's killing jobs, they're talking about those jobs, and those people, for the most part, are not going to be unhappy to leave their jobs. They're dying to do so and hanging on for dear life until they get to 65. So that's one thing. In terms of the employer requirement for coverage, there is no employer mandate in the law. So the law does not require an employer to offer health insurance to all their workers. There is a requirement, though, for employers who have more than 50 workers. If you have more than 50 workers, then you are required, beginning in 2014, if some of your workers end up going into one of these new state exchanges and getting subsidized coverage financed by the taxpayers and everything else in the bill that's financing it, then you as an employer are going to have to pay part of the cost of those subsidies. But it's only for larger employers. It's not for smaller employers. And it's not the full cost, but it is part of the cost.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Danny in Cleburne. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I've got a question. I'm underneath what they call the Indian Bureau.
Indian
as far
Health.
As the care and health care.
Yes.
So when if it comes down to where, you know, I'm out of a job or something and I get too old or something and I can't afford insurance, you know, do I have to have insurance? Because, you know, the Indian Bureau aid or whatever is going to cover any kind of medical stuff that I have.
So if you are low income, then there are no mandates on you to have to purchase coverage. You will have options available to you that don't exist right now. And in addition to that, the Affordable Care Act includes a very significant modernization and upgrading and improvement in the Indian Health Service that the administration is implementing right now. So if you are in a low-income situation, the individual mandate is not going to compel you to do anything or pay any penalties.
What percentage of Americans are likely to remain completely uncovered even after, let's assume that the law, for the sake of argument, let's assume that the law stays in place.
Yep.
How close do we get to 100%?
So the estimate is that if nothing happens, right now we have about 49 million uninsured Americans, and the estimate is that by 2019, if we didn't do anything else, we would have close to about 55 million uninsured Americans. The Affordable Care Act is estimated, if it's fully implemented, to cover 32 million uninsured Americans. So if the law is fully implemented, by 2019, we'll still have about 23 million uninsured Americans. And so it's important to know who those people are. The big bulk of those people, about 40% of them, are estimated to be people who will be eligible for state Medicaid programs but simply don't move forward and enroll in coverage. We'd like them to be enrolled to get preventive care services and things to keep them healthy. But the truth is that if they get really sick and they show up at a health center or a hospital, they will be able to enroll and get covered on the spot. So that's the largest group. There's another group, about 25%, who are undocumented immigrants who will not be eligible for any particular benefits under this law. And then there are those people who will voluntarily choose to say, listen, I don't want to buy health insurance. I'd rather just pay the fine, and that's what I'm going to do. And so those are really the three major groups. There's a smaller group of people who will still be uninsured and won't have affordable options available to them because of their employer situation. But those are the major groupings of who's going to be left.
Any concerns, John, even with a potential mandate causing a lot more people to be on the rolls, that insurance companies who are now paying higher rates of taxes on their income and having to provide a lot of benefits without copays that they haven't provided before, that they'll simply decide they want to get out of the business? It's not worth it to them?
Well, we didn't see that experience in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing increasingly is that the insurance industry is where there's growth, and where they are moving is by moving into, for example, the Medicare program and Medicaid programs, because that's where a lot of the increase in coverage, where there is an increase, is happening. There are, afraid to say, some significant number of insurance operators out there who basically make their money and do their business by enticing young and healthy people to enroll and dropping them as quickly as they can once they get sick or require any particular bills. A lot of those plans will probably leave the market when guaranteed issue takes effect in 2014. And some people will regret their passing, and I think that the market will actually be better because there'll be a higher quality of firms that are providing health insurance across the board in the United States. We've certainly seen that in Massachusetts.
It would certainly arguably be a good thing to get people covered who have not had health coverage before. But for those of us who have had decent coverage all along, can we expect after 2014 that we might get a little relief on the price, or are we likely to continue paying at least as much in premiums as we have been?
Well, it's hard to imagine a situation in the United States in the foreseeable future where we actually see the cost and price of medical care going down, unless we figured out some way. I understand that about, you know, if your premium dollar on average, about 85 to 90 cents of the dollar is going to pay for medical services. And, you know, one of the things that's clear from a mountain of research over years is one of the reasons medical costs, in fact, the chief reason medical care costs so much in the United States compared with every other country that covers all those people and has at least as good and better quality results as we do, is because we just pay everybody more in the United States than these other countries. We pay physicians more, we pay nurses more, we pay hospitals more, we pay drug companies more, we pay home health care companies more, we pay nursing homes more, you name it, and you compare the rates we pay versus other countries, and we're just sky high. And so, you know, unless there's going to be some significant drop in those numbers, which is hard to foresee, then, you know, we're not going to see any dramatic decreases. So the aim, the effort, is to try as much as possible to restrain the rate of growth, that health insurance premiums rise, restrain the rate of growth that that hospitals and physicians are increasing, you know, the prices of their care so that it is more in line with the growth of the overall economy. That's really the goal in the sense of the best that we can do.
John E. McDonough is professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. His new book is called Inside National Health Reform. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.